Welcome to This Week in Dystopia. I am Christopher Robichaux, your host. I am a senior lecturer in ethics and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. On Monday, February 26th, the Joblessness and Urban Poverty Research Program at the Wiener Center at Harvard Kennedy School and the Student Association for the Alleviation of Poverty and Social Inequality hosted a discussion with Walter Scheidel titled, A Few Lessons on the Role of Violence in Reducing Inequality Throughout the Ages. Walter Scheidel is the Dickinson Professor in the Humanities and Professor of Classics and History at Stanford University. His research focuses on ancient social and economic history, with a particular emphasis on historical demography, labor, inequality, and state formation. He's interested in comparative and transdisciplinary approaches to the study of the pre-modern world and has been trying to build bridges between the humanities and social sciences and life sciences. In this discussion, we talk about his most recent book, The Great Leveler, Violence and the History of Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century. If you're interested in the book, check the show notes for a link.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. And I'm glad to see that even Harvard has broken doorstops, which is impressive. You also forgot to mention that I published on Buffett of Empire Slayers, if we should have a conversation about this. That's right. So anyway, before we get to that, though, we have to address the serious stuff. So what I tried to do in the book is to do something that it sounds very grandiloquent, but nobody had really done before, which is to look at the search for dynamics of the evolution of economic inequality, distribution of income and wealth across all of recorded world history, which is not the same as all of world history, but just the bits of world history we actually say something about. And my inspiration was, in no small measure, that we come full circle with the French Thomas Piketty's work on capital in the 21st century, where he pointed out, as is well known, that the great equalization of the first half of the 20th century was very much driven by violent dislocations. I thought, well, that sounds familiar, because I've encountered this in earlier periods of history, and I had the intuition, it wasn't really more than an intuition, that this might actually apply to all of known history. And when I actually went and did the work, it turned out to be about 98% true. That whenever you discover significant reductions in economic inequality, industrializing societies, modern societies, surprisingly, it doesn't make any difference what level of development you are at. They are usually almost invariably linked to some major disruption of the established order, to some often very violent, casualty-rich event. Now, they come in four flavors. I use the simile of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which are on the cover of the book, because they are four, but they are apocalyptic. Two of them are the ones we no longer have to worry about very much. They were dominant for thousands of years of pre-modern history up to, say, the end of the 19th century, its state collapse and very severe epidemics. And the logic in both cases is very easy to understand. Almost all states in history up to quite recently were, of course, extremely unequal politically in terms of the power structure, highly stratified, hierarchical, predatory. They were engines for creating even more inequality, benefiting disproportionately a very small ruling class. And so the inverse is also true. When those states unraveled, when they collapsed for any number of reasons, this process would be reversed. And everybody might have been worse off than before, but the rich simply had more to lose. Most recent example, in fact, is Somalia. So it continues almost all the way up to the present. If you think of Somalia before the collapse of the Siad Barre regime, it was a very brutal kleptocracy where very few people siphoned off resources, foreign aid from all over the place. And when that regime fell, we associate the resulting situation with, you know, chaos and bloodshed in Somalia, but it seems to have reduced inequality in a very undesirable, bad way, but that was the actual effect. That's something you observe all over recorded history, going back to pharaonic Egypt, as Mesopotamia, fall of the Roman Empire, fall of Chinese dynasties, you name it. There are more examples than I could cover in the book. Second factor is very severe epidemics. epidemics that kill a sizable share of the total population, like bubonic plague at the end of antiquity, in the high Middle Ages, in the 14th century, the Black Death, when the Europeans came to the Americas and introduced measles and smallpox in the 16th century. There are very few occasions in world history when this happens, but it does happen repeatedly. And when that takes place in an agrarian society, let's say a third of all people die, but the physical infrastructure remains unaffected, the demand for land goes down, the demand for labor goes up. And so as a result, people who sell their labor get more for their labor. People who own the means of production are going to get less. The poor are going to be less poor. The rich are going to be less rich. A compression occurs, which lasts only for as long as the epidemic is active, operational. Once it goes away, population recovers to previous levels. Inequality also recovers to previous levels because you go back to square one. And that can, you can trace this even in some ways to the Irish potato famine in the middle of the 19th century. It's probably the last such example in world history. Come 1914, two new factors enter the scene, very closely related: mass mobilization warfare and what I call transformative revolution, World War I, World War II, the communist revolutions, Russia, China, all the various satellite regimes. In the case of World War I, World War II, the situation is quite complex. It depends on what country you're looking at. You have a whole array of factors, some of them more important in some places than in others. Ideal, typically, if I had to construct an ideal, typical participant in World War I, World War II, what happened was, in order to pay for this unprecedentedly intensive form of warfare, tax rates had to go up to extremely high levels, 94% on top income in the US, 70% top estate tax rate, even more in some other countries. Politically unfeasible, of course, in times of peace. You had massive government intervention in the private sector, or effectively a planned economy, even in market economy systems, dividend controls, price controls, rent controls, and a number of things, disruption of international capital flows, full employment because of conscription plus war industry. In many countries, not the US, but in many others, physical destruction of the capital stock, housing, factories, shipping, mostly owned by rich people. Any number, I'm sure I've forgotten some, any number of factors coming together in varying configurations, producing this particular outcome. And wherever we have decent data, without exception, there's a massive, very sudden, very intense drop in inequality, especially in the distribution of income during World War I and especially World War II. Then there are second-order effects, knock-on effects, a huge increase in trade union membership, right after World War I, a slump in the interwar period, and then a new high in World War II. In the US, labor union memberships, I think, peaked in the early 1940s and has been going down ever since. You see the same in many other countries in Western Europe, in Japan, all over the place, because concessions, it's a bargaining process. Concessions had to be made to workers in this very unusual situation. There's a huge push for a formal democratization. If you think extension of the franchise to women in the US right after World War I, that's not an isolated phenomenon. There's a whole cluster of such events right after World War II, and another one right after World War I and World War II. I think in France, women couldn't vote till 1945. Is that, yeah? So there are many, many examples like this. You also arguably, it's more difficult to measure, but arguably you have a change in attitudes. It does affect people, the experience of shared sacrifice that shapes the generations most directly involved. And of course, then all these things sort of fade over time, right? This is not something that can necessarily be maintained indefinitely. We'll get back to that in a moment. And then the fourth factor, transformative revolutions, obviously very closely related. They're an outgrowth of World War I in the case of Russia, World War II in the case of China. Once you have communists take over, it's part of their program to alleviate, to reduce inequality. Once you expropriate the rich, often killing them or expelling them in the process, you nationalize all the land, all the factories, all the capital stock. You have a planned economy where you set all prices and wages. Well, there isn't going to be any formal wealth inequality anymore, hardly any, and very little income inequality, and the extent is going to be determined by the central authorities. That doesn't really require any further explanation. So, and those factors 3 and 4 together account for most of what we see between 1914, 1950, let's say, in terms of a contraction of income inequality. It takes a little longer for wealth inequality, because wealth is sort of more resilient. If you work for inheritance taxes, it just takes more time for those wartime measures to percolate through the entire population, because, you know, year by year, it whittles down inherited wealth and so on. And so you get a more gradual decline in wealth inequality and a sudden decline in income inequality. But the trend and the underlying causes are the same. That's a process that led to a stability in developed countries in terms of levels of inequality, famously for about 30 years in the late 70s or 80s, depending on which countries you're looking at. And then, of course, there has been another surge to very varying degrees in inequality, extreme surges in post-communist countries, Russia, Ukraine, China, for different reasons. Quite substantial surges in Anglosphere countries, US, Canada, Australia, Britain, less so in continental Europe, but there's not a single country in which no increase in income inequality and wealth inequality has been observed. It just varies depending on institutions and any number of things. Same is true of India, with the retreat from protectionism. So Indonesia, Pakistan, very populous countries have been affected by the same trend. It's really Latin America that in the early 2000s was a bit of an outlier. What happened in Latin America was that inequality fell from extraordinarily high levels to very high levels. Now, of course, I can't just select on the dependent variables. I have a whole section in my book trying to find counterexamples. I was actively looking for examples of meaningful, measurable equalization by nonviolent means, not in any meaningful way connected to those four factors. I've more or less come up short. For most of history, control of the land, of course, was the most important variable for determining inequality. There are hundreds of attested cases of land reform in history going back thousands of years. Most of the time, they didn't get very far. The more peaceful they were, the more orderly, the less bloody, the more previous owners were compensated, the less the effect was on overall inequality. The more violent these land redistributions were, the more successful they were in terms of reducing inequality, Zimbabwe being the most recent examples. And of course, communists are particularly extreme, a variant of this principle. And democracy per se, if you look, if you cast your net very widely, as Dharana Chimodlu did here at Harvard and then Jim Robinson. If you look at this globally, democracy does not have a systematic effect on economic inequality, because there are just too many different types of democracy. I don't need to tell you this. You know more about this than I do. There is no universal effect. Trade unionization, the percentage of the population, of the workforce organized in labor unions, does have a negative effect on inequality. It does reduce it. But that's not an autonomous, that's not an independent factor, because it's very much driven in many cases by the experience of in the first half of the 20th century. You have seen a great abatement, at least outside Scandinavia, ever since, not just in the US, but in many other countries too. Then, of course, you can have investment in education. That's a very broad variable. Of course, there has been increasing investment in education all over the world and to varying degrees over the course of the 20th century. But again, if you look specifically at the United States, it's really striking that the entire net reduction in the skill premium, the premium you earn if you complete high school or you get a college degree vis-a-vis lower skilled workers, 100% of this reduction took place during and right after World War I and during World War II, at no other times. So these changes in returns on better education are discontinuous, and they are very heavily mediated by these violent shocks, because they just dramatically change the demand for different types of labor and so on. In fact, skill premiums in the US have been going up ever since the late 1940s, even through the GI Bill, where you'd ordinarily think that had an equalizing effect. It didn't really. It slowed down this trend, which has accelerated in the last generation or so, but the effect is already visible from the late 1940s onwards. Same is true of financial sector wages, a very powerful proxy of income inequality. Whenever people in the finance sector make much more than people in other sectors, that's a sign that overall inequality is going to go up. It was stable during the Depression, collapsed during World War II, remained stable for a while, and has been going up since the 80s. So wherever you look, you find more and more evidence in support of this thesis, which I confess surprised me. I thought I would run into more complications, into more counterexamples, the complicated stories. Historians always talk about everything is more complicated. I'm sure it is. But in this case, about 99% of the evidence I found more or less supports my thesis, which I guess is sort of depressing. So what does that mean, your question is going to be, what does this mean for the future? Now, of course, the easy answer is to say, well, the past doesn't determine the future, right? We can learn from history, but it doesn't determine anything that's going to happen from now. Now, warning, that's what people might have thought in 1950, right? They might have thought, all the stuff is over, we went through these cataclysmic conflicts, now we have proper democracy, unions, you know, equality, all these wonderful things, the franchise. This is never going to come back. You fast forward 50 years, income inequality in the US is the same as it was in 1929. So it doesn't really quite work that way. So again, this could happen now. Maybe the 21st century is going to produce wonderful things that haven't happened before. But, you know, the historical record doesn't inspire a great deal of confidence. The one thing we can be sure of, well, there are two things we can be, well, sure. One thing we can be confident about and one we can be sure of. The one we can be confident about is that, at least right now, there's nothing on the horizon that would indicate that any of these four violent leveling forces is about to come back. States are much more resilient in most of the world outside Central Africa, parts of the Middle East. But, you know, most people live in states that are much more stable, robust than they used to be in the past. The state collapse, not really a violent option. Great epidemics might happen tomorrow, for all we can tell, but will probably be checked by advances in genetics. Communism, not that popular right now, I guess, and there doesn't seem to be an alternative ideology that pushes for the same kind of violent redistribution. Next war, if there is another world war, it's going to be a very different war. It's going to be a high-tech war without this kind of mass mobilization. Technology has moved on. That's not going to happen again either. So that's good, because nobody wants equalization via these mechanisms. On the other hand, things we can already see is there are forces pushing in the direction of higher rather than lower economic inequality. Globalization is ongoing. There is, of course, populist rumblings and so on, but the process itself is still in full swing. It increases inequality in developing countries. India is a wonderful example. It, of course, it lifts all the boats, but at different speeds. It disadvantages certain groups in developed countries. All this is, of course, well known. We have the issue of automation, which is generally open-ended. Nobody can tell how far artificial intelligence, robots, and so on are going to take us. Economists will say, well, everybody will still, either we won't work and we all have a universal income and we'll all be happy, or everybody will have higher skilled jobs. But even if that is true, I'd be, as a historian, I'd be skeptical, this is not going to happen smoothly. Even if that were to happen, it would entail massive dislocations and disruptions for a generation or two. It would certainly have a disequalizing effect. Living in Silicon Valley, I dare say I know what I'm talking about, because that's a cradle of disequalization currently in the world, not just in the US. Another thing is secular aging. Not so much an issue in the US compared to Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Japan, increasingly China, I guess, in the foreseeable future, which for any number of reasons is also going to have a disequalizing effect, because you have to spend more money on the elderly, on healthcare, and less on overtly redistributive programs. And arguably, we already see the effect of this in Japan, which is quite isolated, and South Korea, where pensions are extremely low and more older people are actually really not well off in this very thriving economy. And this is going to, something is going to happen badly in Western Europe over the next generation or so, because the current system may not be sustainable. The answer, of course, is immigration. If you're in Europe, immigrants are going to come from Africa and the Middle East. They are culturally, ethnically, religiously different. This might move the Europe more in the direction of the US, where you have had greater diversity for a very long time. People arguing that this is one of the reasons for why Americans have always been more skeptical of more radical redistributive programs, because the homogeneity of society is just more limited than in other places, certainly than in Japan, and also in Western Europe 100 years ago. So all these things are sort of about to happen, and we can project and predict and guess about them. But that's going to be the landscape for the next 50 years. And after that, before that, probably we'll have genetic modification and cybernetic enhancement of humans, where some people will be able to have either improve themselves or their offspring in expensive ways that will not be available to everybody else. There are more than 200 countries on Earth. It cannot be banned. It will be done somewhere, eventually by someone, probably in Asia. And that is going, in the long term, has a potential for inequality we can't even imagine at this point. Because at least now we're still all humans operating sort of on a reasonably level play field that may also change in the future. That's still science fiction, but again, people are effectively working on making this happen. So in that sense, it's hard to see how inequality can be successfully, not managed, but reduced. There are models for successfully managing existing levels of inequality. Scandinavia has been very successful, France, a few other places, others not so much. But really reducing inequality, as would be desirable, especially in the US right now, by peaceful means, there is really no historical precedent for that. In the absence of a world war, in the absence of the Great Depression, New Deal, that sort of thing, in the absence of something really dramatic, it's never happened before. And it seems unlikely to happen anytime soon, regardless of what Bernie Sanders says. So that's sort of the, in as much as there's any lesson to be drawn from history, I fear that's it, pretty much.
Well, thank you. I feel we're done.
Yeah, we can just go on.
Wow. And I thought I was dark. thank you very much for coming and for sharing your thesis and the ideas of this book. I just have a few questions I should just tell you. I'm going to put this over to you very quickly so that you can start asking your questions. I guess my first one is, I'll start with a bigger picture one, and then I want to turn to policy for a moment. It seems the theme of your book is not just that here are these dramatic ways to reduce inequality, but and since we did pop culture, I'm gonna go Jeff Goldblum, Jurassic Park, and just say that inequality finds a way. Right. In other words, it's not just that it takes these catastrophic things to upend it; it keeps coming back. And what I'm hearing you say now is sort of big structural things like a combination of capitalism and democracy, welfare state capitalism, democracy. You're not confident in all that that's going to do it. How much do you agree with Piketty's thesis that capitalism in itself sort of creates inequality if it's left to its own devices? I mean, do you reject Kuznets? I mean, do you think that this is that the thesis of capital in the 21st century is broadly correct?
I would go further than Piketty. I would say any kind of civilized development creates inequality. The only truly equal people are hunter-gatherers, who are virtually gone at this point. They had to be equal because they had virtually nothing. They lived in small groups and they moved around all the time. And there was no, they would have liked, we can tell, even anthropologists have a sense, maybe they would like to have inequality. I mean, some people would like to have more than others. They just can't in this particular context. Once you break out of those constraints, once you settle down, you farm, you herd, you have private property, you have transmission of wealth to the next generations, you can model this. You can start with a society that's totally equal, and inequality will automatically arise unless you redistribute every generation, which is very difficult to do for any number of things. So the answer is yes, but it's not just that. I mean, you could say agrarian societies were even more disequalizing because of the way they were set up. Some people would control land, concentrated violence, keep everybody else in check. So in a sense, capitalism is a better version of this because it makes everybody better off, or most people better off to a significant extent, but it has the side effect of being disequalizing. I think that's certainly true.
Right. So we're, a second question that I'm going to open this up is, we're a policy school, and there's a lot of folks here who would like to pursue policies that help address to some degree wealth and income inequality. Is this, I mean, I guess I'm asking in some sense to reiterate, but is there any small space of hope in which policy intervention should be pursued, or are the structural features of this in the historical record just so large for you that you would call up politicians right now and say, look, don't even bother, spend your time doing other things, this is not going to work?
No, I don't think so. In fact, the reaction to my book was interesting because you had the right-wing commentators saying, Scheidel proves there shouldn't be any progressive policies because it doesn't work anyway. And then the left said, Scheidel is a defeatist because he says we shouldn't do anything against inequality, which neither one of which is quite what I had in mind. What I wanted to show, it's really hard. So to do as Piketty says, let's have a global tax on something or other, that's not going to happen. He himself says that's not going to happen. Even within the European Union, it's not going to happen. Even individual countries, large ones like this, it might happen, but it's not likely to happen. So I've identified, just by doing the research on this, a real deficit, which is whenever you look at the prescriptions, they're usually done by economists. And economists have, you know, they can do a laundry list of 27 things, you know, Stiglitz, Atkinson, you name it, that would reduce, reliably, no doubt, reduce inequality. There's a huge deficit in the political science sphere about implementation feasibility. There's sort of this missing link between, you know, this would work, and this is the outcome, and how you get from A to B, you have to actually make it happen. And I don't see a whole lot of work on this. So everybody here and in associated programs should spend more time thinking harder about feasibility and what's possible. There's the low-hanging fruit phenomenon, which is how it worked in Latin America. Latin American countries are not exemplars of, you know, mature democracy and so on, but they have achieved real progress in terms of equalization, especially of income, not so much of wealth, by manageable policies. And if you have very high levels of inequality, even modest interventions make a real difference. So if you are in Sweden, you have to work really hard to maintain current conditions. That's a full-time job. If you're in the US, you could arguably make a real difference by implementing reforms that are not radical, not dramatic, that would actually be supported by a majority of the electorate if it's presented the right way. It's not going to get us to Sweden, but it could make a difference, just as governments in Brazil have made a difference. So that's certainly possible. So I think we are never going to get back to 1950 in that sense. There's just no viable path, I think, for all the reasons I outline in my book. But it doesn't mean we can't make some progress. We just have to be aware of the fact it's really difficult, and we have to have just a more realistic, broader understanding of how to go about doing it.
Thank you. I was actually listening to Sam Harris's podcast last night, and he was interviewing Neil Ferguson, and your book came up. And Neil's response was that while it's true that inequality has risen on at a country level, global inequality has actually decreased quite a lot. And I'm curious to know whether you think that is a meaningful critique or whether it sort of misses the point of what your book is, or your thoughts on that.
No, I mean, it's that's a success story. I should say, I mean, there are many success stories. Look at other types of inequality, race, gender, you name it, right? They have all been going down to various extents, and they're unlikely to come back. It's just, as you said, economic inequality seems to be very resilient and always find a way to come back. Now, as for between international inequality in between countries, or if you took a census of the entire world population, that has in fact been going down, that was bound to happen, because global inequality is a phenomenon ultimately of, to a large extent, a phenomenon of the 18th century, 19th century. We have industrialization and modern economic growth in some parts of the world and not in others. As a result, global inequality had to go up in this phase. Once other, especially very populous countries catch up or allowed to catch up, China, India, and so on, it is bound to go down. That's a process that is bound to continue. If you have much higher growth rates in developing countries and in developing, inequality is going to go down. That's almost a given in this case. What's striking is that in both cases, even in developed and developing countries, while this process is underway, inequality goes up within those countries. Now, very few people, I'm not going to say nobody, but very few people, well, some people are going to lie awake at night fretting about the degree of international inequality. A great many people should lie awake at night fretting about inequality within their own country, because that's where the political process takes place, right? That's what's going to affect political voter behavior and so on. Nobody, I don't think voters care very much that inequality, I mean, people in India are now less poor relative to the US than they were before. But they do care what's going on in their own country. So I think if you approach this from the perspective of especially policy making or of politics, within country inequality is really, I'm not going to say more important, but more a more charged topic in a way than international inequality. So yes, it's true that inequality has been going down. It will continue to go down. As far as we can tell, that's almost inevitable in a way. But that in itself doesn't really solve the more pressing issue, the politically more pressing issue.
Sorry if you cover this in your book, but I was wondering if you could articulate a little bit more why there isn't a fifth horseman that involves, you know, peaceful political action and voting and things like that.
Well, it wouldn't be a horseman then. It would be something nicer, I guess. Mm-hmm. So the problem is people always make these lists and they say, well, look at the 20th century, what happened, right? We had the wars and we had the depression and we had spread of democracy and unions and all kinds of things, more education and industrialization, deindustrialization, all this drives development. But if you look at this more carefully, it seems that these are not all independent factors, and many of them are actually contingent on some of these violent shocks. If you take the shocks out of the equation, the other stuff wouldn't just have happened the way it did. And that makes it very difficult to look at, you know, purely peaceful reform in a way, because, I mean, I speak now as a historian, maybe pedantically, but how do you define something as genuinely peaceful if it is meaningfully rooted in these violent shocks? And if you then think ahead in terms of policy proposals, you always have to ask yourself, would the recipes that worked in the past work in the current context, in the current global environment, where this particular impetus is missing, right? So you could say, well, of course we should have high taxes and restrictions on certain features of globalization and more genuine democracy and more of this and more of that. But, and that may work, but in the past it only worked because that impetus was given. So in that sense, history can't really teach us anything about how to, you know, bring about this genuinely peaceful change in the absence of this violent, you know, context.
Thanks for coming in. So I just had a question on your historical examples, looking at state collapses, obviously like the Cultural Revolution, the Bolsheviks in Russia, and the epidemics. Those were during times where the wealth distribution occurred through seizure of hard assets, so property, plant equipment, etc. Today, obviously, a lot of wealth now is tied up in fractional ownership in financial assets, stocks and bonds. So it's much harder to sort of have that equality leveling in this current environment. And also, if you look at the economy, a lot more wealth is in services and technology where it's not physical hard assets. So how much does that complicate things in terms of having a situation to, you know, rebalance wealth?
I would imagine it does. I mean, you could still, if you had really massive government intervention in the private sector more generally, it would drive down the valuation of shares, for instance, because, you know, it would affect profits and profit expectations in the longer term. So it would have that kind of effect, but probably not as much as in a factory-driven economy. And generally, deindustrialization has a disequalizing effect because it makes it more difficult for people to unionize. There are any number of things that push in a certain direction away from this. So that's one of the many reasons why I think it is more difficult now to do that than in the past. So I would certainly agree with that. And of course, the other one is global openness, right? If you can shift things around as you can now, that makes it much easier. It was remarkable that this period of equalization coincided with a massive hiatus in globalization, right, between 1914 and, in a way, up to the 70s, till you have, you know, the deregulation really kicking in. And that has by itself an equalizing effect because it contains some of the things that allows a few entrepreneurial people, capitalists, to benefit disproportionately from sort of global movement and so on.
So we've been talking about measures to reduce inequality nationally, especially given the recent election. A lot of us have been thinking more about local and state politics. And so I was wondering if you've thought about, we've heard a lot of our mayors talk about inclusive growth. And so how do you think about policy reduction from a policy perspective at the local and state level versus the national level, if you've given that any thought?
I haven't, but I wonder how many other people have, because whenever you look at the literature, it's all about thinking big or maybe too big. That's what I meant when I said, you know, we lack proper analysis of what might actually work in the political sphere at what level. Maybe that's the right level. I mean, if you're in California, you have almost 40 million people. That's a start, right? That's just one example of how we may have to just not just always look at what worked in the past, but think hard about what might work in the future.
One thing that you reminded me of was we were talking about this, and you made the distinction, of course, between poverty and income inequality. Now, this is a big question, but sort of a working assumption of this whole conversation of the book is here's, you know, inequality. And it's here are these terrible things that have to happen in order to address it. But is inequality so bad? If we can't get rid of it without catastrophic sort of events, can we reduce it enough so that it becomes a tolerable level? In your historical research, did you see clear evidence that it was always a horrible, that income and wealth inequality was always terrible? Or did you see examples of saying, well, it was manageable, but here's the things that happened anyhow? I mean, should we be as concerned about the fact of inequality as many of us are?
Right. That's actually multiple questions rolled into one. And one you didn't answer, but I'll answer anyway, is did high inequality cause any of those violent dislocations, right? And the answer seems to be not systematically. Oh, the French Revolution, look, the king lives in Versailles, and there had to be a revolution. Well, all the other countries in Europe were equally unequal. England was even more unequal. There was no revolution. So there are any number of variables. And Russia and China were not terribly unequal when the communist revolutions happened. That's why nobody expected it to happen. Therefore, it would happen in the highly unequal industrial societies, but not certainly not in China. So there is that. No, I got too wound up in my own question. What was it?
How seriously should we be preoccupied?
Yes, sorry about that. Yes. So, I mean, economists would say, oh, there's good and bad inequality, right? Because in as much as inequality is a byproduct of economic growth, everybody is better off. We shouldn't worry too much that someone has 100 billion and I don't, because I'm still better off, and so on and so forth. And that is, in a way, true. You get a real problem once you have the situation, as in the U.S. since the 70s, when the real wages of male workers don't go up since, I don't know how long, and all the real household income growth comes from women's labor market price appreciation and so on, which is great on the one hand, but it also points to some underlying problem. So once inequality becomes so pronounced that some small segment of the population siphons off all or most of the increase, that's obviously not desirable. And it's going to have some feedback into the political sphere eventually. So I think it's difficult to really identify the reasons for why inequality is bad. It's certainly less bad in some quasi-objective way than some absolute level of poverty. If you can ensure that everybody has a roof over their head and all the rest of it, and access to basic services, that's more important than ensuring we have an inequality level like Sweden. I think few people would disagree with this. On the other hand, high inequality can be destabilizing, even if there's no systematic relationship, in especially political terms, in terms of perception. I don't think it's a coincidence that we started talking about this with the financial crisis. Before the financial crisis, economists knew this was going on, nobody really cared. Last 10 years, this has been the big deal. 1%, all these terms were coined, really, or became popularized in this decade. I think in large part as a response to the sense there is something broken, unfair in the system, and we latch on an inequality as such as being one of these really evil things that will tear society apart, that maybe, in a way, an exaggeration, in a way, or maybe not quite the right emphasis, but it shows that the issue of inequality has great psychological power. And it certainly, to some extent, underlies both the Trump and the Sanders campaigns, I think that's, and you know, campaigns in France and England and so on, and will no doubt even more so in the future. So you don't even need inequality to be objectively destructive. Sometimes if millions of people are languishing, they languish in the streets, but not because of this. But it may have an effect on politics, and that's potentially quite scary in a way. And that's one of the reasons why this really deserves our attention.
See if we have a few more questions really quickly. Thanks.
Yeah. So you mentioned two wars in the United States. So you talked about World War II, and you said shared sacrifice and very high democratization of the repayment, and then the Civil War, and you talked about profiteering. So I'm very curious, what were the different factors that led one war to increase, mm-hmm. and sort of what were the values that led to that?
That's an extremely good question, and someone should probably start this in more detail. What I argue in my book is that the Civil War was almost one of the last traditional wars. Well, one side wins, and the other side really loses. And on the losing side, historically, you would expect inequality to always go down, because the winners are going to take stuff away from the ruling class of the losers. If the Civil War had been fought a few hundred years earlier, the North would have taken the slaves from the South and moved them North. I mean, this is a bad analogy, but that's what happened historically, right, in cases like this. That didn't happen, but there wasn't yet the system in place that would have pushed for, high tax rates and so on, unionization. It was still a largely agrarian society, less urbanized, less politically mature, however you want to define it. So there are very significant differences. So I think it's one of the last traditional wars. In World War I, in World War II, nobody wins. It's not true. The U.S. always wins in World War I and II economically, but nobody else does. Not England, nobody, right? Everything is trashed and really in trouble. And that's also why, arguably, the effect of those wars on the U.S. is the weakest compared to many other countries, especially World War I. U.S. involvement in World War I is very modest compared to the European powers, where World War I is often worse than World War II. World War II is very different because there is reasonably high mobilization. It's preceded by the New Deal, so there are already institutions, arrangements in place that could simply be scaled up, which again marks the U.S. as quite unusual. There aren't really other countries out there in which the Great Depression had an equalizing effect on quite the same scale as in the U.S. In most countries, it has no equalizing effect, amazingly enough. So the policy response is very poor. Well, you have Germany, but that's an extreme response if you switch to a Nazi regime. And the Nazi regime was actually highly disequalizing. So the only country where the Great Depression produced peaceful change via the New Deal was actually the U.S., which is remarkable. And that in itself, because people think of, didn't this happen elsewhere? Not quite in the same way. Other countries had to mostly wait for World War II. And then when it arrived in the U.S., much had already happened in the second half of the 30s. Not quite as much, but quite a bit, and you could sort of build on that. So the U.S., I'm not going to talk about American exceptionalism, but in some way, the U.S. is a bit of an outlier in this entire narrative.
There's a significant debate about immigration in our country, and I wonder if you have some thoughts regarding mass immigration, how that affects economic inequality. I noted that average wage has not increased in like 30 years in our country, and there are some parallels between cheap labor and mass immigration in our system today. What are your thoughts regarding that?
So I can't offer any original thoughts on this, because what I found in the literature is that the effect of immigration, say in the U.S., picking up mostly in the 80s from Latin America in particular, has a very small effect on overall inequality. Maybe different for wages in some sectors, but if you look at overall income inequality in the U.S., the effect overall seems to be quite low. It has, amazingly, a disequalizing effect on the source countries, because if you have a country like Mexico and some people in a given community go to the U.S. and work and send back remittances and other people don't, that actually disequalizes income in those communities. So the effect may actually be stronger, perversely, on the countries that send people to the U.S. than on the U.S. that receives workers from overseas. So it doesn't seem to be a big deal. What we see now in Europe is it hasn't happened yet in terms of having a measurable effect on inequality. What it seems to have an effect on, though, is people's perception. So if you go out and you do all these surveys and you say, are you happy to pay high taxes as you currently do, like 50% state share of GDP, if the beneficiaries are increasingly
from somewhere else. And people unsurprisingly say, no, I'm not happy about this, because that's what people say. So this hasn't yet had an actual effect on real policymaking. But we are very much at the beginning. And all the demographic projections for Western Europe in particular is tons, millions, millions of people coming in, being needed to maintain economies, the welfare system, and so on. And once that happens, it remains to be seen whether these survey projections are gradually turned into reality and then begin to maybe subtly undermine the consensus that upholds the welfare state, very expensive redistributive welfare state that is typical of continental Europe. That may well happen. That's what I meant when I said there might be a shift in a direction of closer to what the U.S. has been for a long time. So it's too soon to tell, in a way, migration, because much of it is still to come, remarkably.
So it seems like, in some sense, your thesis is kind of the opposite of Steve Pinker's and Peter Singer's, in the sense that they both argue that rights and things like it, good things, expand over time. And they do so through peaceful means and stable means and legal means. And I guess it seems like empirically you and Piketty's thesis about inequality is empirically true, as is their thesis about rights, and I'm just wondering if you could like discuss why the discrepancy. So, what makes rights different from inequality? Why is one of them able to increase legally and peacefully, while the other one has such a hard time?
I wish someone wrote a 500-page book on exactly that topic. Right? I mean, I'm not being facetious. Right? It would be a fascinating. I've not seen it. Right? Where someone takes different types of inequality over time, it doesn't have to be from the Stone Age, but it's just the last few hundred years, let's say, and then tries to figure out an answer to exactly that question. My hunch is that economic inequality is more resilient, it's more protean, it can manifest in very different societies, whereas other types of inequality are fundamentally incompatible with having a mature, high education, modern economy, high income system. Slavery, blatant gender discrimination, racism, all these various things are not really logically compatible with a certain level of development. Inequality, economic inequality, it seems more compatible with that. And that's why I think it has a better chance of surviving into the future. Now, why this is, like, structurally, I don't know, because, again, this is something that people should look at more systematically. That's a very good question.
Would you please join me in thanking the professor for coming here and sharing his wonderful thoughts? Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation. Tune in next week for another week in Dystopia. Thanks for listening to another episode of This Week in Dystopia. Like what you heard? Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. Want more information on each episode? Visit our Medium page at This Week in Dystopia. To stay in touch with us during the week, follow us on Twitter at Week in Dystopia and like us on Facebook. Have ideas for future episodes? Want to share your thoughts? Tweet at us or send us a message. We want to hear from you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School.